This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite is sponsored by Cray. The new Cray XC30 supercomputer, powered by Intel Xeon processors, delivers on the Cray commitment to adaptive supercomputing, providing scalability across the HPC performance spectrum. For more information, visit www.cray.com/ownXC30.
This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry, with Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
What China's new leadership means for HPC.
And the race to exascale.
Good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for November 30th, 2012, available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined once again by Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Addison.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, we just, prior to the SC12, we just talked about sort of a change of leadership in the U.S. We got the new elections here. We've got our new old leadership back in a new Congress.
Right. We were looking at the U.S. election results, and then we go right into supercomputing, and we get a little distracted from that. But those weren't the only elections, or I should say political change, selections going on in the world, and some of them have a lot to do with HPC.
Yeah, I mean, while we were during that week, China was sort of reshuffling the Politburo and the top leadership there during the week of the show.
Right, exactly. So it's now been named that Xi Jinping is the new head of the Communist Party of China, which makes him the presumptive replacement of Hu Jintao as president of China. And he'll take office early in 2013. Those are technically five-year terms, but in practice, they tend to get reelected. So you can assume this is a once a decade switch in the Communist Party and the head of China. So the new president of China for the next 10 years, Xi Jinping. And then there's also a new Politburo Standing Committee that's been named, which is sort of like a cabinet from a U.S. perspective. This has been reduced to a 7-person cabinet from 9 in previous years. The president is part of the cabinet. But then most importantly on that cabinet is a new premier in China.
Right. And the reason we're interested in this is over the past 5 years, China has basically become the number two supercomputing power in the world. And change of leadership could affect them. I mean, we talked about it a little bit for how the U.S. elections might affect our future. So what do you think is going to happen here? I mean, these are new people to a certain extent. Do you think China's aspirations or timeline for getting to the next generation of computing is going to change because of this?
Well, like it was with the U.S. elections, you have to peel a few layers deep to try to figure what the effect is going to be on HPC. The top priorities in China around these elections seem to have been, first of all, to control corruption. China's political system has been rocked with some scandals over the last year and a half. And the new president, Xi, has a history of anti-corruption. And I think there's going to be a lot of openness around how he handles the government going forward. The major political goal in his cabinet seems to be around economic development and the creation of a strong Chinese middle class, a lot focused on consumption. There's got to be a lot of infrastructure building throughout China. So there's not a lot of direct HPC implication right at the top level.
Right. And they haven't actually, there hasn't been a whole lot of news out of them for a while on the HPC front. There was that big push when they came up with the 10A machine back a couple of years ago, and it seems like they came out with a lot of these top machines. And since then, at least in the top 500, it's sort of fallen off, or not fallen off, but sort of treaded water a little bit. But we did see at SC12 there was a couple of workshops on what China was doing there, and they seemed to still be pushing for it, but they tended to downplay with their position in relation to the U.S. They still think the U.S. is the leader. They're sort of playing the newcomer on the field.
Right. Now, we won't really know a whole lot about policy until this new fifth generation Communist Party in China releases its new five-year plan, the 13th five-year plan in China. But we can start to make some inference. A lot of the leaders in China, especially recently, have had science and engineering backgrounds. That's certainly true of the incumbent president, who has worked as an engineer in the hydro and electric fields. The incumbent premier, Wen Jiabao, has a seismic background, a major science background, a lot of engineering focus there. And the newer people coming in certainly have some of that, but maybe not to the same extent. The presumptive new president Xi, if anything, is more of an economist than a scientist or an engineer, and that's probably appropriate to their economic goals for the middle class. Now, the new premier. The new presumptive premier named to the Politburo Standing Committee will be Li Keqiang. And he does have an engineering background as well, although probably not as strong as Wen's was. So if anything, I think there's more of a shift away from science and engineering background to more of an economics focus.
So, yeah, what is notable to me when I hear about this is that the executive leadership has this scientific background. I mean, we don't see that so much in the U.S. or even the European nations. That's mostly, you know, economists and lawyers and things of that.
Career politicians, for that matter.
Exactly. You know, so
they majored in political science when they were in college.
Yeah. So you think that could definitely have some effect on this? I don't know how that'll play out, but I think it is. It is worth noting that those
absolutely
have that background.
Absolutely. And this is very common in China. It puts it in sharp contrast to the U.S. and other countries, how much scientific or mathematical or engineering training their leaders have and how much they value it in terms of their own country's position in the global economy. Now, part of that could have to do with when you have a child from the elite Communist Party members in China, what they sometimes call a princeling, they get the better education. They're tended to be guided into science or engineering fields, and then they have political capital from their family background to help them move up in the Communist Party. That's certainly more true, I think, of the more recent presidents, although the premiers have both Wen and now the new presumptive premier Li have come from more modest backgrounds.
Yeah, it is interesting to see this for that diversity there. But you know, when I look at the group, I mean, it's all sort of this older males. I mean, it seems even more conservative than we get here with our democratic elections. It's, you know, 55 plus guys who, you know, we're running this country and it's selected internally. It's a really conservative bent, so it's really up to these guys. It's not the popular will of the people, obviously. It's what these guys are going to think is best for this country. But, you know, I know when I hear discussions about in the supercomputing community about them and about how they're going to go forward, it's almost envious. Like, there's just a few people that are going to make these decisions, and there's not sort of this messy democracy that gets in the way where, you know, money has to be allocated, and it's, you know, there's this two-party system that, you know, sort of prevents things from happening in the U.S. at least. It's a different way of obviously running the country, but in a way, I almost get the feeling that the HPC guys we talked to sort of would prefer that in a way than what we have to do here to get the funds for exascale computing now.
Well, you're right that it comes down to, first of all, you know, who decides that you're going to do it, and then how do you pay for it? And Chinese economy is something that everyone's looking at, and that's the top priority for this new generation of Chinese leadership. You compare that to where we are in the U.S. and things that get voted on but not implemented. And in fact, I think it's noteworthy that the current U.S. ambassador to China, Gary Locke, was the Secretary of Commerce under Obama when the U.S. implemented the U.S. Competes Reauthorization Act, which, you know, was voted in, and we covered on this podcast, you know, in terms of what it would mean for the missing middle and greater adoption of HPC in manufacturing. And the whole thing, after being signed into law, never went anywhere. It became one of these unfunded mandates that was an idea signed into law that never got any money.
Yeah, and just hearing about how that competes sort of fiasco went, that's something that, you know, just wouldn't happen in China. They wouldn't have, you know, legislation that went through and never got funded. They have their five-year plans. It's straightforward. In that sense,
right.
It's, you know, the U.S. is not nearly as efficient in doing things like that. It's this messy democracy that we've talked about. In that sense, they have that advantage. And it's sort of...
We have this messy democracy. I love it, Michael.
Obviously, nobody.
Are you nominating yourself for emperor?
It's nobody wants, you know, that sort of system. But in the sense of making policy, technical policy, it seems to work much more efficiently now. Of course, they're not, you know, reflecting the will of the people here, but they're making these decisions, and policy like that, you know, slides through a lot more easily than when everything's a political contention as we see it in here, and then, you know, even to some extent in Europe and then other democracies.
Well, China does have a good history of following through on its five-year plans. And speaking of plans, you know, we can start looking at what all this has to do with exascale. We had some recent comments from the DOE, so in the U.S. and elsewhere. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about that.
The XC30 series has been designed with a holistic approach to optimize the entire system to deliver sustained real-world performance and scalability across all hardware, networking, and software. The Cray XC30 series leverages the combined advantages of next-generation Aries Interconnect, a flexible new network topology, Intel Xeon processors, integrated storage solutions, and major software environment enhancements. For more information, visit www.cray.com/ownXC30.
So, Michael, we were just talking about China's leadership and what it might mean for HPC and exascale. Meanwhile, at supercomputing, Bill Harrod made a few comments with regards to the U.S. exascale plans from the DOE.
Right. The DOE is now sort of the agency of choice to push, you know, U.S. exascale forward, and you know, as of yet, they haven't had consistent funding for much of those efforts. So they're looking to actually put forth a proposal early in the new year, in February, actually, to Congress to describe what they want to do and presumably the funding they need to do this. But it's now late. This is going to be for fiscal year 2014. If the money's allocated, it won't come in until basically October of 2013, so we're getting close. So he's basically saying,
right,
you know, we can't hit that 2018-2020. You know,
originally, people were talking about 2018
right.
as a target for exascale, following out the logarithmic curve that we've had for all the previous milestones. But 2018's not looking good.
Right, and now he's saying it's probably going to be 2020 at the earliest, more likely 2022, which is quite a distance off.
4 years off, yeah.
And when you, especially when you consider, you know, sort of that trend that the top 500 predicts, where you're going to get something in 2018 or 19, it sort of makes you wonder about where the U.S. is going to be in this mix of leadership machines in 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so then the question becomes, if the U.S. can't put together an exascale machine in 2018, can anyone else do it in 2018? We were talking about the Chinese. You'd have to look at the Japanese. Anybody in Europe? You know, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the componentry will be there. I mean, Intel, Cray, and other vendors think they're going to have, you know, the hardware infrastructure, the technology to put forth for these machines. I mean, the real problem is getting sort of the software infrastructure in place. That's sort of the...
And the power infrastructure.
Yeah, the power, but they think if they can solve the, you know, the performance per watt problem, they'll have the hardware to do that. But it's not a slam dunk that there's going to be software there to get anything like a, you know, an exascale machine working at the capability that machine would entail. I mean, you could always cut up that machine, as it's done now for many systems,
right,
into a series of terascale and petascale applications, but there's no reason to build a hundreds of millions of dollars machine if you're just going to make it into a bunch of little clusters necessarily.
Yeah, I think if the U.S. is going to be out in 2020 to 2022, that at that point you're not going to be the first exaflop machine. Someone will build an exaflop, at least an exaflop peak machine, prior to that, probably in Asia, either in China or Japan. Whether or not you make 2018, I would have to say that's still possible, but not likely. I would put my chip on 2019 for someone getting a peak exaflop system out there. Now, how efficient that machine is and whether or not it's more efficient than or more productive than the next machine that the U.S. would put out in that time frame would be a topic for debate at that time. But I think you'll have the public perception at that point that the U.S. has fallen behind in supercomputing.
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, the policymakers and the public will look at this and say, you know, what happened? I mean, we've seen in modern supercomputing history, it was the U.S. that hit the teraflop mark first with ASCII Red and then the petaflop mark with Roadrunner. We're not the nation to do it for exaflop. People are going to wonder what happened, and probably well they should, although, as we've just discussed, it's probably not as important as far as that particular milestone, as far as what as opposed to what science is going to be done, if there's going to be useful things done on that hardware.
Yeah, so, but then, you know, this has been the argument with a lot of new advancements with regards to clusters and with regards to accelerators and new architectures. People debate the efficiency and what kind of production you can get out of these machines. But on the other hand, you get people who say, look, I'm going to field an exaflop system, and then we're going to figure out what we're going to use it for.
Yeah, and that's happened. I mean, we look at Roadrunner. That was a very unusual machine by a lot of standards. I think some people considered it a stunt machine. I mean, it's done some good work, but that architecture didn't survive. And going forward, you know, there won't be a lot of codes written for that sort of hybrid system the way they configured it. But now, I mean, we're seeing, you know, there's multiple multi-petaflop systems now. There's much more, there's many more petascale applications now. We just saw this week on IBM BlueJean, the system Sequoia, the system at Lawrence Livermore, they had a 14 petaflop sustained application on that machine. That's only 6 petaflops off the peak.
14 petaflops, yeah. A lot of flops right there.
Yeah, that was a cosmology code, and yeah, it was a fairly recent code. And that's quite an accomplishment, and we've seen others. And we saw when Titan
cosmology code here. We're talking about modeling of the Big Bang and such.
Right. It's right modeling actually galaxies and particles in the universe.
Of the universe,
so it's revealing the nature of dark energy and dark matter in the universe. So it's one of these codes that's relatively easy to scale because you know you can scale it to the universe. You're keeping track of particles and energies that can be done very easily with codes like that. I mean, there's some codes that lend themselves to that sort of scale. And we saw something similar when Titan was announced. They had, I think, a 10-plus petaflop application in a material science code. But as you see more of these multi-petaflop systems come up, we're going to see more such systems, and I'm assuming, or more such applications that are going to be able to use that. And I'm assuming we're going to see sort of the same pattern once we get into the exascale era. I mean, we consider the era starts, you know, when we see that first machine. But actually, from the application point of view, it doesn't start until sort of the middle of the era when you get more and more applications that can use it, figure out how to use that capability.
Right. And, you know, this has always been the argument in favor of pushing the new limits of computing, is that the applications will follow along behind. I think you should be designing these for a certain degree of efficiency. I think a lot of the architectural trends that we've had have made the software more challenging. You know, it used to be that a supercomputer was a more self-contained device than it is now, and there's a lot more software work that needs to be done to achieve these levels of scale. But, you know, supercomputing marches on. Someone's going to get to an exaflop. I feel like Kennedy here. I feel like we're going to do it by the end of the decade. Who's going to do it first is an open question. And it sounds like Bill Harrod's almost opting out, saying it's not going to be us.
Yeah, although maybe he's just trying to send a message here, saying, you know, if we don't go down this path more aggressively, this is what's going to happen. I'm not sure how much attention that's going to get. I'm sure he's telling that to the policymakers that he has to answer to, but I think it's still possible the U.S. will have that first machine, but you know.
Not if it's in 2022, they won't.
Not if it's in 2022, that's true. But, and I think, like you said, I think probably China, even more so than Japan, would probably be the most likely nation to get that if it's not the U.S. Regardless, I think we're going to have productive exascale machines at some point, but that's not going to be until the middle of the next decade where we have the applications and the software that's going to catch up to that.
10 years from now, we'll be doing a podcast where we'll recap this story, Michael. So put a pin in this one, and then we'll come back and see how we did.
Okay, that sounds like a good plan.
Right.
All right. Well, until next week, that'll wrap up this show, and we'll start up December and see what news breaks during the last month of the year.
Great. Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right.
This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite has been sponsored by Cray. The new Cray XE30 supercomputer, powered by Intel Xeon processors, delivers on the Cray commitment to adaptive supercomputing, providing scalability across the HPC performance spectrum. For more information, visit www.cray.com/ownXE30.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.